Chapter 16. It's not that. I told you it was no use, Strip. I told you long ago, in Venice. He shrugged ironically. He's not Strip who's asking you now. Strip was not a marrying man. He was only trifling with you. The present offer comes from an elderly peer of independent means. Think it over, my dear. As many days out as you like, and five footmen kept. There's not the least hurry, of course, but I rather think Nick himself would advise it. She flushed to the temples, remembering that Nick had, and the remembrance made Stretford's sneering philosophy seem less unbearable. Why should she not lunch with him, after all? In the first days of his mourning he had come to Paris expressly to see her, and to offer her one of the oldest names, and one of the greatest fortunes in England. She thought of Ursula Gillow, Ellie Vanderlyn, Violet Melrose, of their condescending kindnesses, their last year's dresses, their Christmas checks, and all the careless bounties that were so easy to bestow, and so hard to accept. Should rather enjoy paying them back, something in her maliciously murmured. She did not mean to marry Stretford, as he had not even got as far as contemplating the possibility of a divorce, but it was undeniable that this sudden prospect of wealth and freedom was like fresh air in her lungs. She laughed again, but now without bitterness. Very good, then. We'll lunch together. But it's Stret I want to lunch with today. Ah, well, her companion agreed. I rather think that for a tete-a-tete he's better company. During their repast in a little restaurant over the Seine, where she insisted on the cheapest dishes, because she was lunching with Treff, he became again his old whimsical companionable self. Once or twice she tried to turn the talk to his altered future, and the obligations and interests that lay before him, but he shrugged away from the subject, questioning her instead about the motley company at Violet Melrose's, and fitting a droll or malicious anecdote to each of the people she named. It was not till they had finished their coffee, and she was glancing at her watch with a vague notion of taking the next train, that he asked abruptly, "But what are you going to do? You can't stay forever at Violet's." "Oh, no," she cried with a shiver. "Well, then you've got some plan, I suppose?" "Have I?" she wondered, jerked back into grim reality from the soothing interlude of their hour together. "You can't drift indefinitely, can you? Unless you mean to go back to the old sort of life once for all." She reddened and her eyes filled. "Can't do that, Strip, I know I can't." "Then what?" she hesitated, and brought out with lowered head. "Ick said he would write again in a few days. I must wait, oh, naturally. Don't do anything in a hurry." Stretford also glanced at his watch. "Arkin, Ladition. I'm taking the train back tonight, and I've a lot of things left to do. But look here, my dear, when you come to a decision one way or the other, let me know, will you?" "Oh, I don't mean in the matter I've most at heart. We'll consider that closed for the present. But at least I can be of use in other ways, hang it, you know, I can even lend you money. There's a new sensation for our jaded palates." "Oh, Streff. Streff. She could only falter, and he pressed on gaily. "Try it, now do try it, I assure you there'll be no interest to pay, and no conditions attached. And promise to let me know when you've decided anything." She looked into his humorously puckered eyes, answering their friendly smile with hers. "I promise," she said. XV, that hour with Stretford, had altered her whole perspective. Instead of possible dependence, an enforced return to the old life of connivances and concessions, she saw before her, whenever she chose to take them, freedom, power, and dignity. Dignity. It was odd what weight that word had come to have for her, as he had dimly felt its significance, felt the need of its presence in her inmost soul, even in the young thoughtless days, when as he had seemed to sacrifice so little to the austere divinities. And since as he had been Nick Lansing's wife, as he had consciously acknowledged it, had suffered and agonized when she fell beneath its standard. Yes. to marry Strefford would give her that sense of self-respect which, in such a world as theirs, only wealth and position could ensure. If she had not the mental or moral training to attain independence in any other way, was she to blame for seeking it on such terms? Of course there was always the chance that Nick would come back, would find life without her as intolerable as she was finding it without him. If that happened, then she would cease to strain her eyes into the future, would seize upon the present moment and plunge into it to the very bottom of oblivion. Nothing on earth would matter then, money or freedom or pride, or her precious moral dignity, if only she were in Nick's arms again. But there was Nick's icy letter, there was Coral Hicks' insolent postcard, to show how little chance there was of such a solution. Susie understood that, even before the discovery of her transaction with Ellie Vanderlyn, Nick had secretly wearied, if not of his wife, at least of the life that their marriage compelled him to lead. His passion was not strong enough, had never been strong enough to outweigh his prejudices, scruples, principles, or whatever one chose to call them. Susie's dignity might go up like tinder in the blaze of her love, but it was made of a less combustible substance. As he had felt, in their last talk together, that as he had forever destroyed the inner harmony between them. Well, there it was, and the fault was doubtless neither hers nor his, but that of the world they had grown up in, of their own moral contempt for it and physical dependence on it, of his half-talents and her half-principles, of the something in them both that was not stout enough to resist, nor yet pliant enough to yield. She stared at the fact on the journey back to Versailles, and all that sleepless night in her room. And the next morning, when the housemaid came in with her breakfast tray, she felt the factitious energy that comes from having decided, however half-heartedly, on a definite course. As he had said to herself, if there's no letter from Nick this time next week I'll write to Streff, and the week had passed, and there was no letter. It was now 3 weeks since he had left her, and as he had no word but his note from Genoa. As he had concluded that, foreseeing the probability of her leaving Venice, he would write to her in care of their Paris bank. But though as he had immediately notified the bank of her change of address, no communication from Nick had reached her, and she smiled with a touch of bitterness at the difficulty he was doubtless finding in the composition of the promised letter. Her own scrap basket, for the first days, had been heaped with the fragments of the letters as he had begun, and she told herself that, since they both found it so hard to write, it was probably because they had nothing left to say to each other. Meanwhile, the days at Mrs. Melrose's drifted by as they had been wont to drift when, under the roofs of the rich, Susie Branch had marked time between one episode and the next of her precarious existence. Her experience of such sojourns was varied enough to make her acutely conscious of their effect on her temporary hosts, and in the present case she knew that Violet was hardly aware of her presence. But if no more than tolerated, she was at least not felt to be an inconvenience. When your hostess forgot about you, it proved that at least you were not in her way. Violet, as usual, was perpetually on the wing, for her profound indolence expressed itself in a disordered activity. Nat Fulmer had returned to Paris, but Susie guessed that his benefactress was still constantly in his company, and that when Mrs. Melrose was whirled away in her noiseless motor it was generally toward the scene of some new encounter between Fulmer and the arts. On these occasions she sometimes offered to carry Susie to Paris, and they devoted several long and hectic mornings to the dressmaker's, where Susie felt herself gradually succumbing to the familiar spell of heaped-up finery. It seemed impossible, as furs and laces and brocades were tossed aside, brought back, and at last carelessly selected from, that anything but the whim of the moment need count in deciding whether one should take all or none, or that any woman could be worth looking at who did not possess the means to make her choice regardless of cost. Once alone, and in the street again, the evil fumes would evaporate, and daylight re-enter Susie's soul, Yet she felt that the old poison was slowly insinuating itself into her system. To dispel it, she decided one day to look up Grace Fulmer. She was curious to know how the happy-go-lucky companion of Fulmer's evil days was bearing the weight of his prosperity, and she vaguely felt that it would be refreshing to see someone who had never been afraid of poverty. The airless pension sitting room, where she waited, while a reluctant maidservant screamed about the house for Mrs. Fulmer, did not have the hoped-for effect. It was one thing for Grace to put up with such quarters when she shared them with Fulmer, but to live there, while he basked in the lingering radiance of Versailles, or rolled from chateau to picture gallery in Mrs. Melrose's motor, showed a courage that Susie felt unable to emulate. "My dear, I knew you'd look me up," Grace's joyous voice ran down the stairway, and in another moment she was clasping Susie to her tumbled person. "Nat couldn't remember if he'd given you our address, though he promised me he would, the last time he was here." She held Susie at arm's length, beaming upon her with blinking short-sighted eyes. The same old disheveled Grace, so careless of her neglected beauty and her squandered youth, so amused and absent-minded and improvident, that the boisterous air of the New Hampshire bungalow seemed to enter with her into the little airtight salon. While she poured out the tale of Nat's sudden celebrity and its unexpected consequences, Susie marveled and dreamed. Was the secret of his triumph perhaps due to those long, hard, unrewarded years, the steadfast scorn of popularity, the indifference to every kind of material ease in which his wife had so gaily abetted him? Had it been bought at the cost of her own freshness and her own talent, of the children's advantages, of everything except the closeness of the tie between husband and wife? Well, it was worth the price, no doubt. But what if, now that honors and prosperity had come, the tie were snapped, and Grace were left alone among the ruins? There was nothing in her tone or words to suggest such a possibility. Susie noticed that her ill-assorted raiment was costlier in quality and more professional in cut than the homemade garments which had draped her growing bulk at the bungalow. It was clear that she was trying to dress up to Nat's new situation. But, above all, she was rejoicing in it, filling her hungry lungs with the strong air of his success. It had evidently not occurred to her as yet that those who consent to share the bread of adversity may want the whole cake of prosperity for themselves. "My dear, it's too wonderful. He's told me to take as many concert and opera tickets as I like. He lets me take all the children with me. The big concerts don't begin till later, but of course the opera is always going. And there are little things, there's music in Paris at all seasons. And later it's just possible we may get to Munich for a week." "Oh, Susie." Her hands clasped, her eyes brimming, she drank the new wine of life almost sacramentally. "Do you remember, Susie, when you and Nick came to stay at the bungalow? Nat said you'd be horrified by our primitiveness, but I knew better. And I was right, wasn't I? Seeing us so happy made you and Nick decide to follow our example, didn't it?" She glowed with the remembrance. "And now, what are your plans? Is Nick's book nearly done? I suppose you'll have to live very economically till he finds a publisher. And the baby, darling, when is that to be? If you're coming home soon, I could let you have a lot of the children's little old things. You're always so dear, Grace. But we haven't any special plans as yet, not even for a baby. And I wish you'd tell me all of yours instead." Mrs. Fulmer asked nothing better. Susie perceived that, so far, the greater part of her European experience had consisted in talking about what it was to be. "Well, you see, Nat is so taken up all day with sightseeing and galleries and meeting important people that he hasn't had time to go about with us. And as so few theaters are open, and there's so little music, I've taken the opportunity to catch up with my mending. Junie helps me with it now, she's our eldest, you remember? She's grown into a big girl since you saw her. And later, perhaps, we're to travel. And the most wonderful thing of all next to NATS recognition, I mean, is not having to contrive and skimp and give up something every single minute. Just think, NAT has even made special arrangements here in the pension, so that the children all have second helpings to everything. And when I go up to bed, I can think of my music, instead of lying awake calculating and wondering how I can make things come out at the end of the month. Oh, Susie, that's simply heaven. Susie's heart contracted. She had come to her friend to be taught again the lesson of indifference to material things, and instead she was hearing from Grace Fulmer's lips the long-repressed avowal of their tyranny. After all, that battle with poverty on the New Hampshire hillside had not been the easy smiling business that Grace and Nat had made it appear. And yet, and yet, Susie stood up abruptly and straightened the expensive hat which hung irresponsibly over Grace's left ear. What's wrong with it? Junie helped me choose it, and she generally knows, Mrs. Fulmer wailed with helpless hands. It's the way you wear it, dearest, and the bow is rather top-heavy. Let me have it a minute, please. Susie lifted the hat from her friend's head and began to manipulate its trimming. This is the way Maria Guy or Suzanne would do it. Dot, and now go on about Nat. ... She listened musingly, while Grace poured forth the tale of her husband's triumph, of the notices in the papers, the demand for his work, the fine ladies' battles over their priority in Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.